Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. Good to see you. Tonight, I will be leading a Dharma talk called Relative and Ultimate Reality. Oh, and just so you know, on the Wednesday nights, feel free to join in the chant, even though we can't hear you on Zoom. You're all on mute, but it's good practice. So feel free to join in. One day, several years back, I was walking in a park right outside the Mountain View Library. I was looking at the trees on a beautiful day, and out of nowhere, I suddenly became aware that the tree I was looking at had deep roots in the ground beneath my feet. It was almost as if I could feel the roots growing under the ground, and I could sense that the roots of the trees were just as big as the top of the trees that I looked at every day. I noticed that some of the trees were older and perhaps wiser than I am. And I realized that for most of my life, I had only been seeing the top half of trees, the half which was above the ground. Normally, when we look at trees, naturally, we tend to evaluate them according to their usefulness to us. We admire the beauty of a tree and seek out a tree when we want to stand in some shade. We observe if any of the trees are fruit trees, and we wonder whether we like the type of fruit. It's pretty natural that we look to the ways that trees can serve us. But if we look deeper, beyond the objectification of trees, we see that they are sophisticated creatures. We're learning more about the intelligence of trees. There's some good TED Talks on how trees communicate and a book, The Hidden Life of Trees. Trees have deep relationships. They know who their siblings, children, and parents are. It's common for a grandmother tree, who carries a lot of wisdom of the forest for centuries, to send nutrients, such as nitrogen, to her sapling grandchildren to help them survive. The way these trees communicate is through the mycelium network, which is a network of fungus that grows underground. And through this, the trees can share resources with each other. They can send warnings to each other, such as if they sense a drought coming or danger. They'll send a message that causes the neighboring trees to excrete protective secretions that help conserve water or protect them from the threat. I've heard that when a tree falls down, often the neighboring trees around them will bind their roots together in an effort to support keeping that stump of the fallen tree alive. When trees receive a message through the mycelium network, they can tell whether it's coming from a close relative, from another member of the same species, or from a different species. They're very intelligent. And yet, for a long time, I only saw them on the surface. I didn't see trees in their full complexity, and I still don't. I'm learning more. What I've learned is that we have a tendency to see everything this way. We never see the full picture, the ultimate reality. Everything we experience is filtered through our five senses and through our mind, our history, our associations and experiences of the past. Everything that we experience is called relative reality. It's our subjective world. In Zen, there are common themes of relative and ultimate reality, although they're called many different things in many different texts, but these themes keep coming up. If you want to read more about relative and ultimate reality, you can look in the third chapter of Branching Streams Flow On in the Darkness by Suzuki Roshi. He states, "We do not make much distinction between things that exist outside and things that exist within ourselves. You may say that something exists outside of yourself. You may feel that it does, but it isn't true. When you say there's a river, the river is already in your mind. A hasty person may say, the river is over there, but if you think more about it, you will find that the river is in your mind as a kind of thought. That things exist outside of ourselves is a dualistic, primitive, shallow understanding of things. This is universally speaking. Then he goes on to describe Ri and Ji. These are the Japanese words where Ri means ultimate reality, the source of teaching beyond words, beyond our thinking and our comprehension. Even when you try to describe it, you put a limit on it. So Ri points to that ultimate nature and ultimate reality. Ji, on the other hand, refers to the phenomenal experience, something we can see, hear, smell, or taste, as well as thoughts and ideas. The majority of our life experience is in the realm of Ji. So to give you an example, if we look at a tree and we see the color green, we might think, that's an object I'm looking at and it is green. As if green is an attribute that you can apply to the tree rather than what is truly happening, a phenomena of relational experience. The light of the sun hits the leaf and the blue and yellow parts of the spectrum of light reflect off of that leaf, and then the human eye receives those reflected beams of light. That phenomenon is called seeing the color green. All of this phenomena happens in our mind through our senses. If no one were there to see it, the color green, as we understand it, would not exist. It's not truly reality, it's rather a representation of reality. This is similar to the koan, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, does it make a sound? Some people have color blindness, and when red and green are together, they can no longer distinguish what color it is. So they have a different sensory perception. When you see me, you see a set of colors and shapes and an interpretation. Some of you might recognize me as your friend. Other people will say, that's a human being, looks like a woman, she has tan skin, dark hair, and so on. But now imagine you're in the body of a snake looking at me. Suddenly things would look very different because a snake sees heat better than form and color. So the snake would see me, not recognizing any human form, but instead see me as a blob of red heat surrounded by cold blue surroundings, like an infrared detector. If you were a fly on the wall, a fly has many faceted eyes, so it can see many different angles all at the same time. It makes sense because they need to navigate flying through the air and escaping predators when they try to catch them. So if you put these multiple points of view together, the human being seeing me through the filter as their friend, the snake seeing me as a blob of heat, and the fly seeing me from all angles and as a potential threat, you can get a little bit closer to understanding ultimate reality, but you're still limited to the aggregate of these different relative realities based on different sensory perceptions. The point is that all life forms, our senses are designed to keep us alive, to keep us physically surviving. And as such, we filter out a whole lot of information that exists, which is not essential to our immediate survival. There's so much information passing through us all of the time. For example, radio waves and Wi-Fi signals. Right now, you could turn on a radio station and music would start playing. And you know that on that radio station, music is blasting all over multiple cities, multiple states, and it's through your living room constantly this whole time. But it's invisible to us unless we tune into it. And then there's dark matter, which we don't even know what it is, but we know it exists all over the place. Another example of relative reality is experienced in our mind as the phenomena of phantom limbs. Someone can actually feel a sensation, a pain or an itching in their left leg, while that person actually has no legs. This shows that it's actually all the electrical impulses in our brains that we're experiencing, our sense of our body. We're not actually feeling our body, we're feeling the connection to our body in our brain. This also explains why we can experience sensations in our dreams without the physical stimulus of the body, except for the electrical impulses of the brain. So why do we care? Everything we perceive is subjective to our senses and is not the full picture of reality. But why does that matter? The reason that this topic matters to me is because it's often very easy to feel small and powerless. In a vast, complex universe, facing a lot of challenges and problems that seem way beyond our ability to control, the more we understand our true nature, the more we understand our relationship to everything that exists. The more we understand the limitations of our senses and our perceptions, the more we can actually start to see beyond our senses. And it's in this higher perspective where we can see ourselves a little bit more objectively. We can start to see where do we fit in the grand scheme of things. Our sensations and thoughts are preoccupied with our survival, and the ego is not necessarily a bad thing. If a bus is coming fast down the road, it's your ego that's going to tell you to jump out of the way so that you don't get run over. That's very important. We run into trouble, though, when we think that this relative experience is all there is. We feel separated, isolated, and powerless, trapped in the limitations of our physical bodies. We can become over-identified with this concept that we call I or me. We can become afraid of others that look different. Many of the problems we face today, wars, racism, men versus women, humanity versus animals, the extinction of species, and feelings of isolation all stem from an over-identification with the individual egoic self. When our physical self is in harmony with our multidimensional self, we can start to become into a life of balance. We'll start to realize that we have no constant abiding self, that nothing has a constant abiding self. At a molecular level, we are all in constant motion, always changing. We tend to see things as being separate from us, but a very easy example is take some lotion and rub it into your arm. Within a few minutes, that lotion has become a part of you, a part of your body. Just this afternoon, I ate an apple, and that apple is now being digested and turning into human cells and human fuel, and it's now a part of my body. We do this every day, yet we hardly pay attention to realize how amazing what is happening. If you think you have an individual self that's separate from everything else, I want you to take your age and divide it by 7. Does everyone have a number? So you have your age divided by 7. That's how many times you have completely changed bodies in this lifetime. So I was born in 1983. I've fully changed bodies at least 5 times. Les has changed bodies about 12 and a half times. Every 7 years, all of the cells in your body have cycled through, meaning they're gone and replaced entirely by new cells over the period of 7 years. So the person you are now is not the same as the person you were when you were 4 years old, and you're not even the same as the person you were 5 seconds ago. With every breath, we take in oxygen that becomes part of our body, and with every exhale, we release carbon dioxide out into the universe. So we're constantly interchanging energy with everything around us. Everything we touch, everything we have contact with. There are some religions that actually believe that every object you touch is connected to you for all eternity. This is an important concept to understand because if we really grasp this, that we are constantly evolving and interchanging energy with everything around us, we will see that in ultimate reality, death is not really possible and death does not exist. Now, in relative reality, death is very real and extremely painful. You want to hug a loved one and you can no longer physically embrace them or feel them next to you or hear their voice talk to you because their physical body no longer exists the way it used to. So it's true that we experience loss in our relative reality. But in ultimate reality and in the laws of physics, energy can never be annihilated. It can never be destroyed. And it can never be created. It just keeps transforming. So in the realm of ultimate reality, the concept of death, as we commonly understand it, as an ending, as a loss, it actually doesn't exist like that in ultimate reality. That can bring us a lot of comfort when we truly understand it. I'm now going to mention a couple places in different texts where these concepts come up. It's called many things. For example, in the Harmony of Difference and Equality, it says, all the objects of the senses interact and yet do not. Interacting brings involvement, otherwise each keeps its place. The four elements return to their natures, just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid, eye and sight, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste. When we talk about the elements, we start to understand how interdependent we are. When you look at a tree, how a tree comes to being is a seed planted with earth and water and sunlight. So a leaf is made up entirely of non-leaf elements. Just like that, human beings are made up entirely of non-human being elements. And we all contain the elements of earth, water, wind, and fire. Our body is about 60% water. Did you know that we are actually deeply affected by the cycles of the moon? Just as the ocean tide is affected by the moon, because we're made out of water too. We also contain earth and the air, that's the wind we breathe in and out, and the fire can be linked to our metabolism and our body heat. So we are a part of nature. We are composed of these basic natural elements, earth, water, wind, and fire, that reside inside everything. So that was talking about the senses. In the Heart Sutra, there's a phrase that says, no eyes, no ears, no tongue, no nose, so on. That's actually pointing at ultimate reality, because what do you have when all the senses drop off? And that's also why we practice quieting the senses and avoiding too much sensory input when we do meditation, because when the senses drop off, you can start to sense a deeper reality than the physical body. In the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, it starts with, the teaching of thusness has been intimately communicated by Buddhas and ancestors. I always thought thusness was kind of a funny word. I see that and also suchness in Zen. So the meaning of these words, thusness and suchness, is that we don't have adequate words to describe the beingness of ultimate reality. So all of these words, like thusness, actually point to ultimate reality. But the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi follows it with, just to depict it in literary form is to stain it with defilement, meaning we can't even put words to it and talk about it without limiting it and putting our subjective ideas onto it. It then continues, it is like the six lines of the illumination hexagram. Relative and ultimate interact. Wow. So the illumination hexagram that they're talking about is the I Ching. The I Ching was an ancient divinatory tool that was used during ancient China. There are six coins, and you toss them and you get heads or tails for each one. And depending on the configuration of the two sets of three, that is mapped to an instance of the I Ching. So then it talks about relative and ultimate interact. Now we're talking about our relative sensory reality interacting with the ultimate reality. Here is the last line of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. Practice secretly working within, like a fool, like an idiot, just to continue in this way, is called the host within the host. I did a little bit of research on the I Ching and found they actually have an entry called Host Within Host. And I was curious to understand, what does it mean? You can almost intuitively feel what it means, the host within the host, like the greater host coming into the small host, something like that. In other religions, they say things like being filled with the Holy Spirit, or in different cultures, they talk about the Great Spirit being with you, or may the Force be with you if you're a Star Wars fan. When I actually read about the host within the host, It's actually closely linked to the element of fire. So I looked this up, and this came from the Divination Foundation on the I Ching. Number 30, clinging like fire, or host within the host. Clinging like fire, flames hang on to their fuel in order to keep the fire burning. Likewise, in the human world, everything that radiates light or love is dependent upon something else. Through the webs of our interdependence, we see that everything is related, each thing to the other. Awareness of your attachment to other people is the key that opens the door to knowing your true place in the world. No human is an island. Fire is also a symbol of liberation. Crackling molecules that fly away from hope, paradoxically, by clinging to what is natural and appropriate, we gain inner freedom. I know that's powerful, so you can always look it up on your own, or this is being recorded. So if this is blowing your mind, then just you can always watch the recording on YouTube. But what this is talking about is that our human nature is to cling and to attach to things, to hold on to things. And a lot of times in Zen, we talk about trying to get rid of attachments, like I just want to be detached. But by trying to annihilate my attachments, I'm actually denying myself. I'm denying my nature. The true way to freedom is actually to understand the nature of our attachment, not to try to destroy it, but rather to work with it. Understanding that our human experience is to attach to everything. We attach to people we love, we attach to our favorite foods, we have attachments to our urges that tell us we need to pee, or we want to put on our favorite sweater, or we need to scratch an itch, or we need to buy something, or we're thirsty, we need to drink something. So we are full of attachments. So to deny our clinging nature is to deny ourselves. But what this is talking about in the I Ching is that if you cling to what is natural and appropriate, you will gain inner freedom. So we can look to the wisdom of an oak tree. A tree wants to survive just like us. A tree actually has clinging nature as well. It wants to survive. But a tree's life is a little bit more simple. They simply drink water when it rains, and they drink up the nutrients from the soil. So the tree lives. The tree is a consumer, just like human beings are consumers. But the tree consistently takes up what's good for it. In our complex human lives, sometimes we consume things or do things that harm ourselves or that harm others. Addictions are very common. And I've heard that during this time of quarantine, addictions are on the rise. A lot of alcoholism and drug abuse. And the root cause, most of the time, is that people are lonely. So the key to overcoming addictions is to understand the root cause and to accept our clinging nature. We have natural desires to be close to other human beings, natural desires for intimacy, natural appetites for food. And if we can fill them up and satisfy them with things that are healthy for us and beneficial for the environment as well, then that's what it means to live with skillful means. And if we can use the wisdom of the greater context of these things to fill those needs, then we'll have an easier time rather than fighting with the energies or things we can't change or feeling lost. We will work in harmony in relationship with everything. And then we will find our place in the universe. We will have a meaningful life. We will start to understand that every single action we do, every word we speak, every breath we breathe, every minute, tiny thing we do reverberates out into the world for all eternity, way beyond our comprehension. We'll never be able to comprehend all of the implications of our actions and choices, but we can start to raise our awareness. To understand that we do make a difference and that everything we do has an eternal impact, and that we are inextricably intertwined with all beings, past, present, and future, for all eternity, forever. Thank you. I'm now open if anyone has a question. Janet.
Happy birthday, Bonnie.
Oh, thank you, Janet.
That was a great talk. Thank you so much. I don't have a question. I just want to say how much I love you.
Oh, love you too, Janet. Thank you. It's great to see you. Okay, your name says Chris, but you're, oh, Christine, right? Okay.
Hi. It's a great talk, and I want to share like certain thought that I have as I was listening to your speech, I guess, or sharing. One of the things that remind me of a discussion of attachment, of not avoiding being attached, and that remind me of, I think it might be in the Heart Sutra, but it was a discussion of the opposite, the idea of when you have an emotion of love, then at some point we're going to lose the things we love. So that's the suffering. If we are sticking with love and hate, approach and avoidance, it's a losing game towards the end. So it's really, I think for me, acceptance is neither approach nor avoidance. It's just let it come and sort of deal with it. So that's one of my thoughts. A second thought I just wanted to share. I know the translation was bad. It's actually called Yi Jing, not I Jing. They put an I, but it's actually it's a book of change. So Yi is change.
Book of changes, so that's right. Forgive my pronunciation. Yeah. I'm so Western. Yes, but thank you for the correction. The Yi Jing.
Yeah. It's called Yi Jing, yeah. It's, you know, people, I think it's the translation. They could have done a better job, but it is what it is. But that's definitely, and I tried to study it, but it's a very deep book. I just want to share that. Another thing is about when you mentioned thirstness, and that remind me of from Hindu Upanishad. It's almost similar idea. They call it that. They call it that because they can't describe that thing. So they just call it that. So it's kind of like a pointing.
Right.
And one of the reasons I want to share is because that or thirstness is indescribable. The reason it's indescribable because language operates on the level of the mind. So that state of thirstness or that is beyond the mind. So you cannot actually describe it. So that's what I wanted to share. A kind of an interesting different perspective, but and seem to describe the same thing. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Christina. Yeah, all really good points. Really good points. And I am by no means an expert on the I Ching, right? I actually studied only really that one chapter and maybe a couple related chapters, but it's a very deep book. I feel like we could spend a lot of time really diving deep into that.
Yeah, only few people really understand it. That's what make it fun, right?
It's a fascinating book. It really is.
Yeah.
Okay. I see Chris and May and Wei Kuang. Okay. So, we already got Christina. Okay. So go ahead, May.
Thank you, Bonnie. Happy birthday. I didn't know that.
It's okay. Thank you.
Happy birthday. It's a such deep talk. I almost catch every word, you know, you got my whole attention. I have two questions. One is a little bit funny, maybe for everyone. I know that, you know, every 7 years, our body cells is actually completely changed. Mm-hmm. I'm curious that when the cells actually changed, does it still carry certain memory? Actually, that memory is karma. You know, I assume it is, but then, you know, when we say completely changed, I think they're still not like completely changed, right?
Absolutely.
It's still there's some continuation there, but depends on our effort that maybe we can remove some of the memory, right? Or something, I don't know. I think my son's Taekwondo teacher has a really good, example, she basically said, you know, all you practice is just to get the poop out of your cells. I'm like, wow, that is great. You know, and you know, to describe to kids about the practice about breathing. So the second question actually is about this is a really, really deep this topic. And then I know actually the challenge is always lies in the harmony, right? The harmony of ultimate reality and the relative and reality. Actually, it's all about paradox. And then if there's no paradox, it's not truth. So there's always paradox. And then you know, in ultimate reality, we're all independent. And then, you know, many of the, you know, I come from China, and then, you know, there's a form of codependence, right? Everybody is everybody. So nobody have a boundaries.
We have that.
Right? And that's exactly. And no. And then now we swim to another extreme, is everybody is isolated. It's me and me, or you, right? And that's to the extreme. And then, I feel like the human being is just keeps swaying, you know, back and forth, right? Back and forth, but never like just be in this middle, but it's so hard. So just wondering, like any reference or something. I heard about the middle way, and in China we have Zhongyong, I mean, which is I'm actually a lot of Chinese word, when I hear it, I have no idea about what exactly talking about, because it was so deep, and I can't comprehend. So I know I heard about the middle way, but is there any other thing? I hope there's something just like today, you crystal clear explain this such deep concept. I would love to explore something in the middle, which is so hard.
Thank you, May. I'm really glad you brought up the first point about continuity. So there is continuity, right? I mean, it's obvious because you have some resemblance to what you looked like 7 years ago. So the continuity lies in your DNA and in the patterns and the arrangement of structures. And so even though your cells are changing and regenerating, you still do have some continuity. You still have some memory. You still have some pattern and structure. And it's cause and effect. You know, this is how your body was, and your body is evolving from that point. But what I think is very interesting is you brought up that there's patterns and there's continuity. And I would say, look at it as there's beyond personal continuity, beyond personal identity continuity, there's continuity across the board. So there's even continuity when you die, right? Yeah. That it's actually just a transition, and you continue on in a different form, right? So I think you're spot on with that. There is some continuity, but the point is that there's no clear separation. There's not a really hard separation between ourself and other objects and other people. And so we're always continually evolving and shifting. And so we also have a kind of collective memory, right? The human race and even language continues. So all of these things continue, not only on an individual level, but on a much bigger level as well. So I'm really glad you brought that up. And I could really relate to what you were saying, basically all oscillating between being super independent and then being super codependent. And that's, I think, a very common phenomenon that happens in the United States as well. I'd say the key to working through that and staying kind of in the middle way is staying aware of what's going on and noticing when things shift. Because I think what happens is we operate in one mode, we're a little bit too independent, and then we start maybe getting too involved in other people's lives. As well, it starts out as a good thing. We establish relationships, and that helps to break us out of that super independent mindset. But then we don't keep checking in with ourselves to see, are we staying in balance? And we kind of keep doing the same thing that worked yesterday and that worked last year. And then before we know it, we're on the opposite side of the spectrum. And then we wake up and we're like, something's not working. Oh my gosh, I've like no time for myself anymore because I've made all these commitments with friends and family, and I've kind of lost myself. So then we pivot back the other way, and then we can go into like, I need time for myself, and like excommunicate all of our friends and go to that extreme. So I think part of it is just checking in so that we're always adapting to the fluctuating circumstances. I think our biggest challenge is that we develop habits where we find something that works and then we keep doing it. And then even when it's no longer working, we keep doing it because we're not paying attention that what worked yesterday is no longer working today and we might need to do something different. So I think that just comes into, like you said, how does our relative self stay in a healthy relationship with the ultimate self and ultimate truth. And it just takes constant mindfulness. Yeah. But that's not an easy thing. It's a practice, you know? And I'd say the first step of that is being in right relationship with yourself, having compassion for yourself, knowing that you're going to make mistakes and forgiving yourself and moving on. Actually, you reminded me of, I don't know why this just came up. I meant to talk about this. There's this little quote from Mitsu Suzuki, Suzuki Roshi's wife. It was in one of her poetry books in the introduction. And it's her relationship with herself and with different parts of herself. So she was like cooking and she was doing chopping and cutting on a cutting board. And she accidentally sliced her finger and it started bleeding. And she started apologizing to it. And she said, "I'm so sorry, poor little finger. I'm so sorry. Let me take care of you. I'm so sorry I did that to you." And that sounds unusual, but how often do we treat ourselves with that kind of compassion that we would if we accidentally harmed someone else, you know, or if we see someone else suffering? So it's interesting because not only is there, you know, us and then the greater reality, there's also like, we're not a single entity either. Have you ever had like a part of you that really wants to get work done and another part of you that wants to go have fun and another part of you that's hungry? Like, you know, so we're almost like a whole community. We have our physical different parts of ourselves warring for our attention. And then we have, you know, different emotional parts of ourselves. So I think just holding the whole thing with compassion and awareness, that's the path, you know? Yeah. Thank you so much. Okay. Wei?
Hi, Bonnie.
Hey.
Thank you for the talk. Very deep.
Thank you.
So during the speech, you talk about to see beyond the senses. Usually, how we relate to the world or our surrounding is using our senses, hearing, seeing, smell, touch, things like that. Mm-hmm. So what would it be like to be someone who can see beyond the senses?
That's a good question. I'd say we'll never be able to comprehend ultimate reality completely, continually, right? We have our individual perspectives and experiences, but sometimes we can experience an opening or an expansion of awareness, and we can actually see ourselves in the greater context of things. I think it can start with something as simple as listening to other people's points of view, like listening to other people and their lives and what their lives are like, and realizing that other people have different experiences than us. Then we can also listen to other species, you know, plants and trees and birds talk to us. We don't realize it because we don't usually slow down enough to pay attention. But if you start trying to take care of a garden, like I'm pretty new at that, I usually didn't have time, but recently I've started growing some flowers and things. And I start to learn, oh, the leaves are turning yellow. I've watered it too much. Oh, this one, it's turning a little bit dry. It means that it's thirsty. So it's telling me, you know, but it takes time to learn the language of plants. It takes time to learn the language of animals, of children, and to notice how different things affect us, how the cycles of the moon affect us, how the seasons of the year affect us, how, you know, even things like man-made, like the stock market affects us, like just realizing that we do not exist in a vacuum. We exist in relationship to everything. So I think when we start to do that, like whenever we feel stuck, like I don't know how to get what I want, or I don't know how to resolve this problem, we can start looking at, well, who's involved, what's involved, and what is the root cause of the way things are. And that might open up something. So I think it's just about broadening our perspective and almost being able to observe ourselves as we move throughout the world. And Zen practice is a good way to do that. We recently had a workshop with Paula Arai, and there were a couple things that stood out to me. She talked about when she went to a Zen monastery with a bunch of nuns, and everything was so strict and prescribed, like everywhere you had to be, all your chores, everything you had to do. And so she was supposed to put her towel in a cubby hole, or no, she was supposed to put her towel on the floor when she got into the bath, because she has hair and they just want, the floor was very clean, but she would put it up like a couple cubby holes up. And then when she would turn around, it would be back on the floor. You know, they just kept resetting things. And she started to realize, wow, people are watching me and I impact things. And then she remembered like sitting in the Zendo and they're quiet in meditation, and in the floor above them in this monastery, people, when they got up from their chairs, they scraped the chairs against the floor. You know, they just kind of pushed back their chairs rather than really gently move them back. And everyone in meditation on the bottom floor just heard like this rustle up there. But if you're not in a monastic setting, or you're not in just a setting where you can slow down and notice things, we think all the time like what we do has no impact. And the truth is that our actions ripple out to the entire world. Like, we affect the experience of people. Like something as simple as smiling to someone, hey, how are you doing? That could be the best moment of their day and make them feel so much comfort. You have no idea. And similarly, like when we just kind of, you know, ignore someone or say something rude without meaning it, we don't realize that that could really deeply affect someone too. So I think it's about just listening to the world on a deeper level, and recognizing that all the little things we do make a big difference.
So what sounds like to me is you're saying we can see the pattern, noticing the pattern. That's what it sounds like to me. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, noticing patterns and relationships. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Noticing the relationships between different things, as well as noticing the relationships between different people. You can start to understand a lot if you look for how are things related. Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you. Mike, let's see. Oh, and then Brenda, did you have a question too? Okay, so Mike and then Brenda.
Hi, Bobby. First, I wanted to say happy birthday and thank you for your talk. I'm very glad my client canceled so I could listen to it. You made the point about the interconnection of all beings and the interconnection of the self to everything else. It's sort of a truism in Western ethics that a central part of right conduct is to know thyself. That's sort of a basic fundamental block, at least in certain forms of Western ethics, is to know the self. You mentioned that the ego is important conventionally to sort of avoid the running bus that's sort of about to run into us. Mike, and you touched on this earlier with about how to have compassion for the self. But my question is, what's a skillful way to sort of look at ourselves in a conventional sense, in an ultimate sense? Like, should I think, oh, I'm an engineer? Should I, if I have an addiction, should I think I'm an addict? Or should I think none of these things? Should I think of myself, how should I, what's a skillful way that I should think of myself, or that we should all think of ourselves in a conventional and ultimate context?
Got it. Thanks, Mike. Good question. I think it's important to distinguish what is our true identity and then what is the role we're playing. And they're both important. So the role we're playing might be engineer, but if you notice, roles can change. And I think we often make the mistake of identifying with a role we're playing rather than realizing it's a role. So someone could be a police officer and be totally in charge and have lots of authority, and then they go home and they have to answer to their wife about, you know, something, and she's the boss in that domain, and suddenly the roles and the power shifts. It's just, you know, often a parent with a child will be the authoritarian role, and then the child grows up and the parent eventually is elderly and needs help with their teeth and, you know, making it to the bathroom. And at that point, now that what was the child is now the caretaker and the authority making decisions, and the elderly parent is now the dependent. So it's important to remember that roles can change quite a bit, and they're not our inherent identity, but they're useful, I guess, for social interactions. And in what you said about trying to, how do we see ourselves with a skillful way or skillful means? I'd say the most useful thing is to notice our own reactions. When you said know thyself, a good way to know thyself is to understand how we react to different things. So all of us have certain things that tick us off, right? All of us have certain things that we love, we get excited about. So we have our preferences. And the more that we're aware of our biases, fears, preferences, it's not that any of them are inherently bad, but the more we're aware of them, the more we know ourselves. We know our own limitations. We know what we're good at. We know what we're not very good at. And we can see ourselves a little bit more soberly and objectively without judgment, without saying, okay, I'm not a good cook, so therefore I'm a bad person. It's just a skill set maybe I don't have, which I could develop if I wanted to. And I think that also helps us understand other people, kind of knowing what, you know, they, how they like to be interacted with, how they don't like to be interacted with. So really, to know thyself means to understand ourselves in relationship. You know, what do we care about? And I'm talking about relationships with people as well as relationships with how we relate to food, objects, you know, things, money, all of these things. So I think whenever we try to truly understand ourselves, we have to understand what do we care about, what motivates us, and how do we take care of our life? Does that help?
Yeah. Sort of what do we need to, like, what is, what are our preferences? What are our reactions to things? What are our needs? What are our biases? Yes, that makes sense. So it's not like a fixed identity, like I am a X, you know.
Because, you know, especially in this time where we're tackling topics like systemic racism, we're all inherently biased. We're all unconsciously biased. But the more we're aware that we're biased, we don't act as much out of that bias. Similarly, we're all deeply influenced by commercials and advertisements. And the best way to not be as influenced is to be aware that you're influenced.
Right.
So it's just that level of awareness. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Brenda and then Dave.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. And yeah, just lovely. And the wonderful emergent smile that I have seen in the last month on your face is truly lovely. So what is the host within the host?
Thank you. First, I'm going to comment on the smile. So all I'm going to say about that is I recently changed jobs, and that is my relative reality interacting very well with ultimate reality, whereas before it was clashing. So yeah, it does have real effects on your life. Now your other question, host within the host, what does that mean? My understanding of what that means, and I'd love to hear if other people have additional ideas or perspective, is that we talk about ultimate reality and big mind and great mind and things, and that coming through our individual self, the ultimate reality coming through the relative reality or being in relationship with, I feel like when it's our own, you know, individual small identity, our own individual small existence, our own individual physical body, when that can express the Dharma, the ultimate truth, to me, that is host within the host. So I think of host within the host the same as our individual will aligning with divine will or the great will, and our individual relative reality working in harmony with ultimate reality. So basically that greater host is shining through the small host is the way that I see it. But I'd love to hear if people have additional insights into that. Thank you, Brenda. Dave.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. A couple of times you've mentioned the sort of multifaceted and situational character of our everyday ego identity. Once in your talk and then just now in response to Mike's question. Kind of interesting to note, by the way, that just from a purely scientific point of view, one of the pioneers of artificial intelligence, a fellow named Marvin Minsky, wrote a book many years ago called The Society of Mind, that basically says that thinking of our minds as a unitary single thing is really an illusion, and that what it really is a whole lot of different aspects all cooperating like a society.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the thing that your exchange with Mike just now reminded me of a wonderful story I heard about a Japanese Zen teacher who was trying to explain to an American student about the nature of your true self and do it in terms of sort of modern Western civilization. And he said that a lot of people think of that as it's sort of like you go to the movies and you sit down and the lights go down and these previews come on. And you see one preview and then you see a different preview and you see another preview. And you keep waiting for that announcement that says, and now our main feature, because, you know, after all, searching through all these situational selves, what you really want to find is the main feature. You want to find your true nature. But you sit there and you watch the previews and they just keep going and going. And then you notice that they actually sort of start repeating. You see the same, you know, small self over and over again in different situations. He said, the real truth is that there's not going to be an announcement that says, now our main feature, here's your true self, because your true self is the screen.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you, Dave. Right. So we've talked about our body changing every 7 years. So our sense of self is really not limited to our physical body, although we're in relationship with our physical body. So if we want to say, what is this egoic self at the core of it, it's really our consciousness, right? Which is the screen. It's the screen that's observing everything. It's the screen that's interacting with everything. It's the screen that's tasting the apple, that's, you know, smelling the flowers, that's observing things. And you bring up a good point about there, I forget what exactly was that you said, something about, yeah, like there being a committee and voting and like we're not an independent individual self. And the way I know this is because I can be in a work environment and no matter how good my intentions are, if I'm surrounded by people who are being very competitive and very political, I end up starting to be political to try to survive. And on the other hand, if I'm in a work situation where people are super collaborative and just love to share and support each other, I become more open and collaborative. I wish I could say that it's my willpower and I choose who I'm being. And to some extent I have that power, but it's very true that I am deeply influenced by the people around me, subconsciously, consciously, like, people, like the people in the company you keep and the environments that you're in affect you. Same with like whether you're in a healthy situation or breathing clean air versus dirty air. You know, it's just, we are not as independent as we'd like to think. You know, our thought patterns are contagious. And similarly, though, we influence other people. Like laughter is contagious and insight is contagious and wisdom is contagious. So sorry, you just got me going on a whole bunch of different things. But yeah, I think that you're right that the ego, or I don't know if I want to say the ego, but our experience of this I or this me is basically the space and the consciousness in which all the phenomena exist. That's a very good way to describe it, as the screen in which all these things are appearing.
And what you were just saying about the fact that it's not by force of will that you adopt these various facets of your personality, but it's largely almost contagious from the situation. Reminds me of something I heard somebody say recently. They said, when it comes down to it, free will isn't about being in control of everything. It's accepting the fact that you're not in control of everything and taking responsibility for it anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Columbine.
Hi, I don't have a question yet. I have to listen to it again and maybe I'll have a question. But yeah, I just wanted to say happy birthday, and I liked the talk very much, and congratulations on your new job. I know that was, I'm very happy for you. And yeah, let me listen to your talk again. I really liked it a lot, and I may have follow-up questions.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Columbine. Yeah, you know where to find me, so.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Right. Oh, actually, that reminds me. That's one other thing. I really wanted to say thank you for, hosting all of these things, kind of coordinating Wednesday evenings and a lot of the sittings. It's I'm sure many people are very grateful, but I'm definitely very grateful myself. So thank you very much for that.
Oh, you're welcome,
Colin. You're here.
Yeah.
Your existence gives my existence meaning, so I love being here too. Christina, you had another question? Go ahead.
More of comments. So one of the things I just jotted down some thoughts as other people are speaking. One is about senses and relationship with senses and our identification with our jobs and so on. And I'm thinking about what senses is really an illusion, just like an identification. A lot of my ideas coming from listening to other spiritual leaders, so I'm not taking credit for those, but I just wanted to share that what I learned is what is not permanent. The impermanent things are not real. So our senses are impermanent. Our identity is impermanent. So those are not the real selves. Mm-hmm. And that reminds me of the Ha Sutra, right? Form is emptiness, emptiness form. So what does that mean? I have been really trying to understand. And one of the things I heard the best explanation is really form is more of a manifested form, when emptiness is more the unmanifested. So that, again, you can kind of go back to the host and non-host. So I'm jumbling some idea together, but when I hear about host with host, I'm thinking of an yin yang symbol. When you have the white with the black and black with the white, that's when I visually think about host within a host. But I haven't really thought deeply more about that. So I just wanted to share. Another thing is, how do we deal with our senses? And I think it's just like the TV on the screen, and to know it's not real, right? So we are playing a role. Right, we have a job, we are playing that role, but we have to identify with what's the permanent one as our true self. Mm-hmm. I have, again, look across different sort of spiritual teaching. One of the things is really, where do you spend your time on? Right, just like Bunny says, if we spend a lot of time on our jobs, it consumes us, right? If we spend a lot of time seeking sensory pleasure, we talk about addiction, that's what we're going to identify with. So, I think people talk about this. Once you work for a while, you are your job, because our personality that's how we manifest. So to really kind of ground it back to the true self is really about meditation, because the more we spend time in meditation, when we are not playing any roles, when we can, obviously we can working on not observe into our senses, and that's when we're gonna be more familiar with our true self. And I do think able to sense beyond senses is possible, but I do think it's a lot of hard work. And some of us may never get to it in our lifetime. Again, whether you believe in reincarnation or life after death, that's a goal. I think we thrive to get to there. And one of the things, just quick, senses mind, just a quick from a psychological perspective, it's really our perception is actually generating our brain. And we have visual illusion to show evidence of that. And also we see people who have mental illness, they can hallucinate. So it's not our senses, sensory organ per se, but it is the illusion that generating our head, which changes from different people, different brain, different mind, we see things different. So that's what I want to share. Thank you,
Christina. That was a lot of really good information. I don't necessarily have a correct answer to this, but I do have a couple things that came up for me. So when you were talking about form is emptiness, emptiness is form, and the Heart Sutra, there's also no eyes, no ears, no nose. A lot of that was very mysterious to me when I first read the Heart Sutra, like in 2010, but soon after my grandfather died. And after my grandfather died, the first time I heard the Heart Sutra, right after he died, I suddenly had an awakening that my grandfather is still here. He's not lost, but he just has no eyes, no ears, no nose, no form, but he's not really lost. He's not really completely gone. And I couldn't figure out how to put that into words, but I just had the sense that he's not, there's nothing's really been lost. It's just that he has no form, but he's, you know, and I can't really explain it. But I guess one way to think about it is our whole concept of form and loss and form and emptiness, a lot of that exists within the constructs of time. Imagine if you could step out of the construct of time. Now that's getting really complicated, but the point is just that because everything has causal conditions, that what we are is inherently related to what has happened in times past. We can't really separate from times past. So my grandfather, although he was in physical form at a different point in time, his existence is inextricably intertwined with my existence. I have his DNA. I could not exist without his existence. The child can't exist without the mother or the father, and so on. So a lot of these things are very difficult to even try to put into words or even to try to comprehend, but I think it's good that we explore them, because the meaning of something as profound as the Heart Sutra can change over time depending on what we need. And we can just see a little glimpse of an opening depending on what point we are in our life. So thank you for that. And there was something else you said, but I can't remember what it was. I'm trying to remember. There was another point, but I can't remember the last part. It's okay. Maybe it'll come back to me. But yeah, that was good. Thank you. So Travis and then Umar, if Travis is back, I don't know. Oh, okay, you have a phone number. I see. So I need to unmute the phone. Got it. All right, now you're good.
Bonnie, can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can hear you.
Okay, cool. Yeah, thanks. I'm up in the Sierras, so I get a better effect if I call in on a cellular line and then have the video too, right? Because of the bandwidth.
Forget about that. I'm sorry about that.
No, thank you for your talk. I was thinking about the butterfly effect you were describing earlier, and then Mike was talking about the ethics of Western culture as being knowing thyself. And then Dave was talking about, what Dave was talking about?
He was talking about us being the consciousness. Well, that was my word for it. He said the screen on which all of these things occur, the space in which consciousness arises. That's our individual self.
Right. So the screen, like the blank tableau, which is Platonic, it's an ideal that we seek for, and an open society has to maintain. It has to maintain the Platonic ideal, even with the Aristotelian scientific method, right? So I'm really encouraged by your talk tonight and the way in which you mix ultimate and relative reality. And I think when we're talking about social change, when we're talking about how we're going to make a small effort to change the world, that's all there's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Little people making big efforts. And I feel that, and I feel that in your talk. And so I just wondered if you could go back to the butterfly effect and say more. Thank you.
Mm. Thank you, Travis. Yeah, I know that butterfly effect comes from a term about like the wings of butterflies and how that impacts the entire forest, and someone else can explain it a lot more eloquently than I can probably. But yeah, I can just kind of recap what I was saying, which has empowered me a lot when I'm feeling helpless in any situation, is just knowing that we cannot even comprehend like the impact of our actions and over time. You know, for example, if we are a good friend to one person and that changes the way they interact with their family and friends, and that changes the way they interact with their family and friends, that has the butterfly effect. And this can happen in a lot of small ways of interaction. And when I look back and think about who I am today.
Well, can I interject?
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, like, you're gonna make a flap of a butterfly's wings.
Mm-hmm.
And the effect is gonna be bigger than the biggest billionaire in the world, right?
Well, you don't know. That's the thing. You really don't know, but you know your intention that you're putting out in the universe like a seed, and that will germinate. And you don't know, is it going to be twofold, threefold, 100-fold? But I'd say that our intentions really do matter, our really sincere intentions. We plant those seeds out in the universe. And it's not even just the actions you take. Every thought you think, every single thought impacts the world. Imagine that. Right.
Well, I think we live our lives, and we have a course to run, right? And you know, I think Mike brought up the idea of free will and the idea that we don't have to submit to the mechanisms of the world, right? Like we can do what we think is right. Even if we're not powerful, right? But that the collective actions of good people have never ceased to change the world.
Right. Yeah, there is the collective aspect of it. That is one thing. But there's another dynamic to it as well, which is the relational aspect. So one thing is having power in numbers. The more we raise awareness and consciousness, let's say, about a particular issue, then the needle starts to move on that issue. But it's also about personal effectiveness. Like if I understand how to relate to someone in a particularly effective way, I might be able to have a bigger influence or have a better relationship with that person because I understand them and took the time to see where they're coming from. And what I was going to
say, relative,
yeah, go ahead.
So relative, the relational reality is just as important as the ultimate, would you say?
Yes, and actually, right after you started talking, I remembered what else I was going to say to Christina, because Christina, you were mentioning the second part was about how, okay, well, we experience relative reality, our sensory input or experiences are not, quote, real, and that there's even people with mental illness that have experiences that are not manifest in physical, and to some degree that's true, but I also want to be careful that we don't minimize relative reality. And even an experience that someone has, like let's say a dream where there's no physical basis, that could have a big impact on their life. So our personal relative subjective experiences are important, and actually being really intimate,
yes,
with our own personal identity is really the only way we can change the world, or I don't even want to say change, it's the only way we can be intimate with the world and intimate with our lives.
Well,
yeah, go ahead, Travis.
Yes, and I think that's what the I Have a Dream speech is about.
Mm.
That's the relative reality. This is the world that I dream of, and it will be coming to pass.
Yes, thank you for that. So
thank you.
Even the realm of what is quote, not real, is real in a different dimension. It's real in the realm of imagination and the realm of creativity. So for any invention or social movement or new thing to come into being, someone first has to imagine it. I guess there's also a few accidents that happen and result in inventions, but you know what I mean? Like the power of imagination and creativity, it's incredibly valuable. And it's something that too often we undervalue as a society. We say, okay, we value what makes money and this and that. We don't value imagination. And then someone like J.K. Rowling writes the Harry Potter books and she becomes the richest woman on the planet. You know, it's like sometimes we don't value things because they haven't come into existence yet. And they just exist in the realm of the imagination. But it can, you know, it is valuable. The power of imagination, the power of vision, the power of, you know, our creativity and our relative subjective desires. I think, you know, that comes with that relative and ultimate interacting in a healthy way. It's like when we can take our deepest wholehearted desires and manifest them in a way that is beneficial for everyone. It's like our gift to the universe when we can do that. You know, because our desires, our deepest desires, not like, oh, I kind of feel like this, but like our really deep desires come from a deeper place, and they come from a deeper place than something that's fleeting or even something that's maybe bound by this lifetime. So, yeah, the subjective relative reality is important. And when it comes down to it, it's actually not separate from ultimate reality, right? It's actually not separate. There is no separation.
No,
it's just a different,
of course not.
Different angle, right? We are all part of that reality.
I think Suzuki Roshi said at one point, there's nothing absolute in this world. So thank you, Bonnie. Thank you for your talk.
Right, thank you, Travis. Umar.
Hi, Bonnie. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Great to see you.
Good to see you too. So, I think you know, you guys were talking about, you know, reality and all this stuff. I'm not that much of a complex person as you guys are. I know simple things, and I was thinking, you know, I read in Kaz Ta-Nehisi's book about the Heart Sutra, and that the way he defines form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Emptiness, he said, and I talked to him about this too when he came to Canando, I think it was 8 or 10 years ago. And he said, what has happened is that the Heart Sutra went from Pali to Chinese to Japanese to it kept on getting translated. So he said, if you change, and this is what he talks about in the book too, that he said, if you change the word emptiness to boundlessness, it just completely flips. So it's saying that we are bound, but we're not really boundless. We're also boundless. Something that is so big that you cannot put it into words. So we call it emptiness or call it boundless. So that's one point that I wanted to bring up. Mm-hmm. And the way that I saw host within a host is it's a very simple way that I see host within a host, and which is if somebody comes to my house and I prepare tea for them, I put cookies out and I put everything together in a very, very, very simple way for them, and I get ready and I sit down and have tea with them. If that person does not show up, I'm going to sit down with myself. I am the host and I am the guest. Mm-hmm. And this is how I see the host within the host. It's about taking care of me and also taking care of other people. So this is why I said I'm not that, you know, complex. I don't know how to present complex ideas. I see things in a very simple way. So food too, if somebody comes to my house, there's a knock on my door and somebody says, oh, I haven't eaten, or it's one of my friends and says, shows up at dinner and says, oh, come and sit down and have food. And this is the food that we're preparing for ourselves. We're setting the table, we're cleaning, we've cleaned up, we set the table, we poured the water, we sit down and we bow to the food and sit down and eat. And if somebody doesn't even show up again, even for dinner, it's the same thing. But we take, for me at least, you know, it's all about taking care of things and saying this is, you know, there is a certain form that I would take when it comes to preparing food, setting the table, you know, keeping everything in on the table in a certain order, and taking care of myself as if I was the guest. So those, I mean, so for me, it's just, I don't know, it's just very simple, and that's how I see it. And you guys were talking about, you know, absolute and absolute reality, and I would, you know, what came to my mind was from Billy Idol, that there is nothing pure in this world and there's nothing sure in this world. So you know, it's from White Wedding. So that's my two cents. Thank you.
Thanks, Umar. And I think it's great to think about things very simply. I mean, that is what, you know, when we get through all this and study it and study the I Ching and all of that, that's what it recommends, is basically take care of your life, you know, just eat food when you're hungry, drink water when you're thirsty, be as simple as an oak tree. So I think that's really great perspective. So thank you. I also see a comment from May that I think is beautiful, where the host is like the water within the host, the wave, the water within the wave, or the ocean within the wave. Right, that's the perfect analogy. And you could even say that it's partly water that gives us our consciousness. So I don't know if you wanted to say more about that. And then I also see Jayashree. Go ahead, Jayashree.
Hi, Bonnie. Happy birthday. I could not wish you. So I had to come in. But I also had a question, comment. And going back to the, I guess maybe just leapfrogging off of May's comment on the water and the wave, and Dave's comment on the screen, the blank screen, and just our focus on so much on ourselves. I feel like really, if you think about it, would there even be ourselves without some light shining on it? And I've heard different interpretations of this, what that light would be. But it's really the idea that, are we really separate from the larger reality? And we, you know, is it just our small mind playing with us, you know, our egoic self telling us things? But think, we're a blank screen. That's all we are. And should we really be focusing so much on trying to know who we are? We just are. And we're a blank screen and nothing more. And would we be there without something greater and bigger, whatever that is? I've seen that same analogy in the Hindu tradition, where the light is something divine. And I know we don't subscribe necessarily, you know, follow that or have that idea here, but it's a bigger notion that, and that perhaps, so this is just more of a comment of, you know, we talk so much about this blank screen, but that's all we are. And so, yeah, I just wanted to add that to the discussion. And it kind of follows with May's point that it's the wave and the ocean, the wave and the water. So the blank screen, we are just part of something larger and greater. And perhaps just accepting that and not trying to ponder too much on it is kind of how I've always felt. But so just wanted to share that. And again, a very, very happy birthday and a beautiful talk. Thank you so much. And your face is glowing.
Thank you, Jayashree. I think it's my little lamp right here that I put so that I'm not in the dark. But yeah, maybe it's divine light, who knows. So yeah, very good points. I think you're right. Like, are we separate? No, we're not. We're really not separate. We just feel separate. And sorry, you made another point. Like, should we think about it so much or just accept? Yeah, I think we do accept, but I think a lot of times we're trying to understand our place in the universe and understand our nature. But a lot of it you can't do really just by thinking and thinking. You have to do kind of by experiencing and feeling. And I think that we exist so much of our identity. Yeah, like fundamentally, we're just kind of a blank screen in consciousness, but our experience through life is a lot about relationship. And who we are is very interdependent. So for example, you're a teacher. You could not be a teacher if you didn't have students, you know, and just everything like that. You can't be a doctor without having patients. You can't be an engineer without, you know, being an employee or an innovator, one or the other. It's just like so many facets of our identity are dependent on other people and other beings, that really we are who we are in relation to everyone else and everything else. There's not much of an identity if you try to see it in a vacuum. Like, it's kind of, yeah, we're not really separate. We just feel separate. But thank you for that. Any last comments or questions? Diane, go ahead.
Wait, you already unmuted me. Happy birthday, Bonnie.
Thank you.
You are glowing, and that was a wonderful talk. Maybe I've undergone many of those seven time changes, and so I'm kind of at the end of the road of that. And I feel very, very connected to nature. And this may sound gross, but so many people after they die are embalmed or put into crypts, or almost like they want to be preserved. They want their body to be preserved. And lately I've been thinking about death and what I would want. And I've heard that there is a way of just being wrapped in a shroud and being placed in the earth. And I may have said this before among this group, but that would be really comforting to me, to think that I could literally become a part of the earth. I mean, we already are. Each element of our body is made up of the same things as the soil and the trees and all other things. But the thought of just literally becoming a part of the earth, it really appeals to me. It may sound gross to some people, but your talk made me think of that again. So.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Diane. So there's becoming more and more creative ways to die, or not to die, but to fun ways to deal with your body or your remains, which is kind of interesting. So some people are making their bodies into fake reefs that go to the bottom of the ocean and help restore the natural habitat. There's this other site, I can't remember the name of it, but you're buried in a place, a sacred forest or a protected forest, where you can say, I want to be near the beautiful pine trees, or I want to be next to the lake, and it's totally protected and you're actually help preserving nature. And so I think all of those are great ideas. Having said that, I don't think we're limited just to our physical bodies. Our physical bodies are how we experience our sensory experience of the world. But I was with my grandma when she died, and I was very clear after she died. I still loved her body, and she still had that hair that I used to stroke, but I was very clear she was gone, you know? So I feel like we have many dimensions to ourself, and I think the physical is one aspect of that. And so it's good to think about. But whenever I think about death, I think the most comforting thing that I think of is I didn't create myself. Like, I, you know, how did I come into existence? Some force greater than I brought me into an existence, and that force is going to know what to do with me when it's time, right? So one of my favorite koans, which I want to leave people with, is what was your original face before your parents were born? What was your original face before your parents were born? And I think, yeah, that's all I'm going to say about that. Great. Any last questions or comments, or we can wrap it up? Well, thank you, everyone. This was a really fun discussion. I love kind of thinking about Zen philosophy, and I really loved hearing all of your experiences. So with that, sorry, anyone here for the first time? I don't recognize anyone. Oh, wait, Balaji, you didn't raise your hand. I think you clicked. Do you have a question? Go ahead.
No, it was answered already. Thank you.
Oh, okay. All right, that's fine. Well, I think I recognize everyone. I guess, does anyone have any announcements?
Next week, Diane will be the guest speaker.
That's right. Diane will be the guest speaker. And Diane.
Happy birthday, Bonnie.
Oh, thank you, Teresa. Diane, do you want to remind us what is the topic next week?
Because I haven't given a talk for so long, and I don't think a lot of new people know me, I was just going to do a Way Seeking Mind talk, just talk a little bit about myself. And then I think empathy and compassion might be a discussion I'd like to hear people's views on that.
Okay, sounds great. All right, you are all unmuted and free to go. Thank you, everyone. It's great to see you all.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.